Case number 21-1371, William LaPlante v. City of Battle Creek, Michigan, et al. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Due to a technical issue, we're missing the beginning 30 seconds of this case.
Well, the struggle on the ground wasn't on the video, was it?
That's true, Your Honors. The encounter all the way up through the takedown is captured on the video. And what the video shows from the start is a volatile encounter where plaintiff was pulled over for drunk driving. His passenger immediately jumps out of the car. Plaintiff stumbles out of the car with a full can of beer in his hand and then repeatedly fails to comply with the officer's commands to put his hands behind his back and to stop moving around. But I think the key moment happens at 1:11 in the video. And that's where Officer Ziegler finally has the plaintiff mostly subdued. His hands are at his side. Officer Ziegler actually is putting his taser away and ready to just handcuff plaintiff and be done with all the nonsense. If there was a time for plaintiff to surrender to the police, if that's what he truly intended, then that was the time. The game was up at that point. But plaintiff instead raises his hands up against the officer's force hands, trying to bring his hands behind his back, crouches slightly and takes a step to his right away from the officer. And it's only at that point, after this point of surrender, after the repeated instructions to put his hands behind his back, that the officer initiates the takedown maneuver and takes him to the ground. So, Your Honors, the district court's denial of qualified immunity was based on the idea that by putting up his hands, it's a universal sign of surrender, no matter the context. I think that's just it's contradicted by the video of what happened here. The district
whether it's universal or not, is it an issue of reasonableness for the jury as opposed to ruling as a matter of law as to how an objective, reasonable officer would perceive the action of putting the hands up in the air? And that's what Judge Neff did. Judge Neff said she reviewed the video, but she concludes that a reasonable juror could conclude that the LaPlante was not resisting and that he posed no threat. And isn't that a jury issue?
So the Supreme Court instructs that police officers are entitled to qualified immunity as a matter of law, unless there's existing precedent that squarely governs the specific facts.
Well, also that you cannot appeal qualified immunity if you dispute the facts. I mean, that's the basic jurisdictional issue, is that an appeal of denial of qualified immunity is a very limited appeal, that you may not appeal the facts as represented by the plaintiff or facts that are not blatantly contradicted by video evidence. And you have to accept the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, and you can only appeal legal questions. And I just question whether there's a legal question here as opposed to a issue for the trier of fact.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. And let me be clear, we are not disputing the facts. The facts are largely locked in by the video, and we accept any gaps or inconsistencies in the video and inferences in the plaintiff's favor. But the only dispute of fact, as plaintiff presents it, is his own subjective, what he was intending when he raised his hands.
Isn't there an issue of fact of how a reasonable officer would perceive the plaintiff's action of putting his hands up, that taking his hands from behind his back and putting them up in the air? Isn't that factual?
I think that is a legal question for the court. And the question is whether existing precedent squarely governs facts similar to this, meaning a close quarters handcuffing situation where the plaintiff has refused requests to put his hands behind his back. That's the purely legal question for the court to decide. There's no further factual development that's needed here. All of the cases that the plaintiff and the district court relied on have involved hands up at a distance from the officers, which is a very different factual situation than we have here. And so the question is whether every reasonable officer
isn't the problem with that argument, Counselor, that this is not just a question of the sole fact of having raised hands. This is the totality of the circumstances. And so you have to see those actions in context. And I'm what the district court said was that there is a dispute of facts about what went on. You say he raised his hands. The court talks about in surrender. You talk about in defiance. Why isn't that just a classic jury question in the context of the full events that occurred as to what that action shows?
The question is whether any reasonable officer in Officer Ziegler's position would have interpreted
all the facts. In all the facts.
Certainly. Under the totality of the circumstances, meaning, 3 o'clock in the morning, passenger jumping out, volatile situation, everything leading up to that, with the plaintiff ignoring 4 commands to put his hands behind his back, 2 commands to stop moving around.
Would you restate that? I missed the numbers you were talking.
You said 4 commands by Officer Ziegler to put his hands behind his back, 2 commands to stop moving around. And the key point there is you finally have him in this position where you're cuffing him. A reasonable officer in Officer Ziegler's position, when you have a suspect whose hands are now at his sides, ready to be cuffed, and then makes a move not to put his hands behind his back, but to put his hands up and crouch and take a step away, reasonable officers in Officer Ziegler's position would interpret that as not submitting to arrest. It's the only.
But isn't that a question? Isn't that a jury question? Because by my count, there were 10 commands from the officer in 30 seconds. And your argument is that he did not obey those 10 commands in 30 seconds. And yet his hands were down part of the time of this 30-second gap. I'm struggling with your position that you get to define that singular event when it seems to me that what you've got are actions within a very short time frame. And the question is, what is a reasonable interpretation of those actions, which seems to me to be a classic dispute that juries always take up.
But
why are you outside that?
Because none of the underlying facts are disputed. All of those commands are clearly on the video, right? All of those clear commands to put his hands behind his back are on the video, and he admits that he did not comply with that.
In fact, the other factor, Mr. Hudson, is he's obviously drunk, and I think the officer knows that or should know that, and the officer says, "Well, stop moving around." And the plaintiff says, "I'm not moving around." I mean, he's so drunk he doesn't know he's moving. He's so drunk that he's not acting. He doesn't respond quickly to the commands. But the officers know how they've encountered drunk drivers before, and I think that's got to be a factor too. And what the decision has to be made is whether the officer reasonably perceives him as resisting, and whether there's a reasonable perception by the officer that he poses a threat. Those are the two factors under the Graham case that I think are dispositive here. And I don't know if we can just say as a matter of law that all reasonable officers would view this drunk plaintiff as resisting, and all reasonable officers would view this drunk plaintiff as a threat. I mean, that's what you're asking us to do.
So first, Your Honor, the fact that he's drunk certainly does not cut in his favor. And in fact, it makes this a more volatile situation for the officer. The close time frame of having to act for the officer also cuts in the officer's time frame. Supreme Court has repeatedly instructed that unless there's a case clearly governing this specific factual situation, not a case on point, but something very close, then not every reasonable officer is on notice that he's violating the law, and therefore qualified immunity is appropriate. And when we have a situation here where all of the relevant facts here are undisputed, all of the commands, all of the refusals to submit to the arrest, submit to the handcuffing, it's very clear that the officer told him to put his hands behind his back so that he could cuff him, and plaintiff resisted those commands. He did not comply, and instead he raises his hands, takes a step away from the officer. Those are undisputed, indisputable facts here. And there is no case that anybody has identified where an officer has been denied qualified immunity in this situation. Closest case. Yes, sir.
I didn't see on the tape that he was actually resisting. Part of the problem here is that when the stop occurred, the officer was executing a traffic stop, which he had a right to do. That was fine. But then the officer jumps out of the car, and instead of going to the car and checking things out and questioning the suspect, as normally would be the case, the officer jumps out of the car and immediately starts yelling at the top of his voice. He's yelling and being inflammatory and provocative as he walks to the car. And that'd be very disorienting for any person, any driver who was stopped. And you just wonder if, and maybe the man was a little uncooperative in his drunken state. I don't know. But with an officer acting that unprofessional, that's got to be taken into account here.
The officer had to get control of this unruly scene, right? The passenger jumps out of the car immediately. The officers needed to go take care of that immediately. And then while that's happening, the plaintiff himself starts stumbling out of the car with a full can of beer in his hand. So it's appropriate in that situation for an officer to aggressively get control of the scene, tell the plaintiff exactly what he needs to know, which is, number one, put your hands behind your back. Number two, quit moving around. And
Why does he have to take him down and throw him to the ground and break his elbow? What does he have to do that for?
He had to take him to the ground because the plaintiff was clearly not listening to the commands to put his hands behind his back.
Why can't you just take his arms down and put the handcuffs on? Why do you have to throw him to the ground?
If you look on the video, there's a moment where the officer is pushing down on his elbows to try to get his arms down to cuff him, and the plaintiff is resisting that. And it's only at that point that the officer then initiates the takedown.
All right. All the statements on the video where the officer's yelling, put your hands behind your back, and the person is saying, take my hands.
Well, he's saying that, but his actions are very different from what he's saying. And in fact, that's the exact same situation that the court faced in the Bozon case that's cited in the briefs, where the suspect was saying, the officer saying, put your hands behind your back, and the guy's saying, I will, but he was not doing it. And even in that case, the plaintiff was not boisterous, combative, or disrespectful. The officer did a takedown maneuver, and the court upheld the grant of qualified immunity there. Your Honors, I see my time is up. I'll reserve
it. Yes, it's been up for a while. Thank you. You'll have your rebuttal time. We'll hear from opposing counsel. I think you're...
Mr. Cabot, you need to unmute. Yeah.
You know, after many times as I've been here, you'd think I'd learn, but good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Sean Cabot appearing on behalf of the appellee, Mr. William LaPlante. I know the court's obviously read everything. The video is critical in this case. And one of the things I'd like to start with the argument today is kind of following up on Judge Clay. And it was one thing that the district court clearly noted from the very outset of this encounter is that Officer Ziegler incites this incident. I mean, even if we step back and we look at before there's even the initial encounter when he's following Mr. LaPlante, we don't have a situation here where he's weaving in and out of traffic, nothing like that. You can see the brake light stop of Mr. LaPlante when they approach the stop sign down the road. Officer Ziegler is driving. He doesn't even stop for the stop sign, turns. And then as Mr. LaPlante begins to pull into the parking spot, then the lights go on. And immediately we have Officer Ziegler yelling. He's swearing. He's just inciting the whole thing. And I think that's important, especially when there was some discussion with Brother Counsel of when you consider these cases in the Fourth Amendment context, you have to look at them in the totality of the circumstance. You just can't take a second or two and analyze it. You have to look at it from A to Z. And I think that's important, especially when you have a video before there's even this physical encounter. And especially when the stop is occurring and Officer Ziegler's actions there. And of course, when you deal with the Fourth Amendment excessive force cases, you have to deal with the standard of reasonableness, which the court has addressed. Graham versus Connor sets forth that standard, and there's basically three things you have to look at, one being the severity of the crime at issue, two, whether the suspect poses an immediate threat to the safety of himself, the officers, or others, and three, whether he was actively resisting or attempting to evade arrest by flight. And so the district court, I think, meticulously went through those factors as it was required to do in the context of the video and found that there was a question of fact here as to whether or not Officer Ziegler used unreasonable force. And when you look at and go through those factors, the court was absolutely correct, starting with whether or not Mr. LaPlante was involved in a severe or violent crime. The case law from the circuit has said, you know, that driving under the influence is not a severe crime. It's certainly not something that we want to happen, but it's not a type of crime, the Sixth Circuit has repeatedly held, that requires an escalated use of force. I think the other factors, again, putting it in the context of the totality of the circumstances, which is required, Mr. LaPlante was not speeding. He certainly, on the other end of that spectrum, he wasn't going really slow. Sometimes you find people who are intoxicating, like driving very slowly. We don't have that here. We don't have a high-speed chase. There's no weapons. He's not weaving in and out of lanes of traffic. He's not weaving in and out of his own lane. He doesn't blow past stop signs. So all those factors weigh in favor of Mr. LaPlante. And then we go to the second factor that we have to look at, which is whether he's a threat to the safety of the officers. Of course, as I previously indicated, he was not driving in a dangerous manner. In fact, he begins to pull over in a parking spot, obviously adequately large enough to fit his vehicle. And when the stop is accomplished, unlike the passenger, and it's kind of unique here because the passenger immediately jumps out of the car. Mr. LaPlante does not jump out of the car. He stays in the vehicle. And it's the passenger who gets out that's repeatedly told to get back in. That command isn't given to Mr. LaPlante. Finally, when Officer Ziegler gets to the driver's side, only at that time do we see Mr. LaPlante open the door and begin to get out. He doesn't jump out. In fact, there's basically a leg that comes out. He doesn't jump out of the car in a threatening manner. And that, when he does that, one thing you'll notice that does not occur and is not said by Officer Ziegler, Officer Ziegler doesn't tell him to get back in the car. And I think that's important because at that moment, there's control of the situation, and Officer Ziegler is not afraid for his safety or the safety of anyone else. Otherwise, he would have given the same command to Mr. LaPlante as he had done to the passenger. Get back in your car. That doesn't occur. Furthermore, you can see Mr. LaPlante's hands were visible. Of course, there's the counter where Officer Ziegler tells Mr. LaPlante to put down the beer, you know, and then knocks it out of his hand. So that indicates that he can see his hand. So he's out of the car, fully visible to the officer, and his hands are clearly visible as well, such that he can see the can of beer in his hands. Also, again, you know, relying on the video, and again, this is what the jury is going to have to assess. He didn't make any sudden movements. He doesn't make aggressive actions. And when, again, I think, you know, in these cases, there's many times if an officer feels threatened, if an officer feels that his or his or her partner's safety is in jeopardy, they'll ask for assistance. He has a radio on. He doesn't call for backup at that point. It's only after the injury and the encounter is done that he call for assistance. He doesn't do any of that when dealing with Mr. LaPlante. And so, again, I think those are important. And then we get to the fact of the hands. Again, they're open hands. And just prior to the force being used, his hands are both open. He's facing the car and his hands are in the air. Now, I know there's been a lot of dispute, both in the trial court and a little bit here today, what exactly hands in the air means. And I know there was some discussion with your honors about that. I think this is exactly the type of thing that a jury has to look at in considering, as it's going to be required to do, the totality of the circumstances of what's going on here, the fact that you have somebody facing the car, and inevitably, you know, I've been doing these cases a long time. One of the first things the officers want you to do to pat the arrestee down is to face the car, put your hands up. I mean, that's what Mr. LaPlante does. He kind of follows generally accepted and normative protocol in doing that, and he puts his hands in the air. You know, and I think that is one of those things, as all the jury instructions say, you know, you don't throw common sense out at the door. And that is obviously one of the things the jury, in looking at this case, is going to say, okay, could the officer reasonably perceive that as being a sign of, I'm going to hurt you? Or is that generally considered a sign of, hey, I'm surrendering here. I'm not a threat.
What are your best cases to support the argument?
So with respect to the hands in the air as a sign of surrender, we have the Baker case, which was a 2006 case. We cited it, Baker versus City of Hamilton. And that, I think, is factually pretty similar, if not even worse than our case. In that case, the plaintiff had, the case law indicates that he was drinking and had smoked crack cocaine throughout the day. He was walking down the street, and an officer asked him to stop, and instead of listening to that, he takes off running. The facts of the case then go on to say that he actually hides in some bushes. And then eventually the plaintiff comes out with his hands up in a surrender position. So again, you have a situation, arguably, that's even more tense, more volatile, more in the sense of a potential danger to the officer than you have here. And we find that the officer hit the plaintiff in the head with an asp, knocked him to the ground, struck him once he was on the knee. The court said, again, he had come out with his hands up in the surrender position. The court said that because he had surrendered before being struck, a reasonable jury could conclude that the officer's strike to the head was unjustified and excessive. The court also went on to say that by raising his hands in a surrender position, Baker arguably showed that he was unarmed, was compliant, and was not a significant threat to Officer Taylor.
Is part of the distinction between our law that addresses noncompliance versus active resistance?
There is some distinction with that, Your Honor. And I think there's a couple of things here before I get into that. One of the critical things I want to mention is that at no time was Mr. LaPlante told he was under arrest. At no time. before the takedown, before any of this. And so I think that's critical. And in some of the cases on talks with active resistance, passive resistance looks at that. And so to the extent that the court would think that there was resistance versus, as I think it was Judge Griffin indicated, he was intoxicated. I believe the record indicated in the lower court he had a 0.115. In Michigan, the legal limit's 0.08. So yes, it was elevated, not horribly, but he was intoxicated legally. I think what you have more than active resistance or even passive resistance is more of a slowness to comply. But even if the court looks at it in the sense of a passive resistance, the case law since at least about 2007 has held that a failure to present one's arms, and that's one of the arguments here, upon request without more is at most passive resistance. And that was in the Griffith versus Coburn case, a 2007 Sixth Circuit case, also Eldridge versus City of Warren, which was a 2013 case. And basically those cases stand for the general proposition that noncompliance alone does not indicate active resistance. And
Before your time gets away, I would like you to address Officer Kirshen, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. We've been talking about the close timing frames here, and I have concerns about qualified immunity for this officer in a failure to intervene because of the short time frame. Our Pelton versus Purdue talks in terms of, let me make sure I get it right, that there's no liability for a failure to intervene claim if the opportunity and means to intervene doesn't last long enough for the officer to both perceive what was going on and intercede to stop. You know, for Officer Ziegler, I have concerns that there were 30 seconds and 10 commands, but that 30 seconds is a very short time for Officer Kirshen to have the means and opportunity to intercede himself. Why does he not fall in the category that would receive qualified immunity?
Well, I think so. Since Anta versus Rutherford, we have the two parts of that analysis. One, the officer had to have observed or had reason to know that excessive force would be or was being used. And so that's factor number one. The second one's he had the opportunity to mean. So I would start with the first and being, and kind of again going back to the totality of the circumstances here. Officer Kirshen should have known just immediately at the initial time of the stop by Officer Ziegler's demeanor for no reason that there was a potential that something was going to go awry.
Yeah, but he had a passenger jumping out of the car.
Right. Okay. So even if we take that, so you have a passenger jumping out of the car, he takes care of that, and then he goes and he deals with Mr. LaPlante. But even with Mr. LaPlante, you have him swearing, you have him knocking can of beer out. We're not talking a distance of significance here. We're talking, what, maybe 6-7 feet a car width away?
Yeah, the problem for me was looking kind of closely at that video, it completing his work with the other passenger. He didn't get to the driver's side of the car until the plaintiff was on the ground. So how, if he is to intervene, how during that, as he's making sure his passenger is intact, how did he have the opportunity to intervene in that from this less than 30 second time frame?
Well, I think when we talk about opportunity to intervene, a lot of times we think of it in terms of physical interaction. I don't think there has to be a physical interaction. We know at about 43 seconds, we see Officer Kirshen looking over the top of the vehicle and seeing what's going on. He can certainly hear what's going on in the tenor of Officer Ziegler. He doesn't even say anything. He doesn't say, hey, let's back it off a little bit. Hey, let's cool it down. he could say something to help calm that, but he doesn't. So yes, while there may not have been means when he's dealing with the passenger to physically leave that passenger, go to the other side, there was certainly nothing stopping him from verbally making some commands to the officer saying, look, let's cool it down. Let's do one thing at a time here. And I see my time is up. But that would be my argument with that, Your Honor, is that while there may not have been a physical ability, there is nothing stopping him from verbally exercising some authority.
Mr. Cabot, how would he know or have reason to know that Officer Ziegler was going to do this takedown maneuver?
Well, I think given the fact that he incites, I mean, just as the officer's tone and the way he's inciting the situation, I think that could give rise to
that
a reason.
You know he's going to do a takedown maneuver because of his attitude? I mean, I don't know. I mean, he looks to me like he decides instantaneously to do the takedown maneuver as soon as LaPlante puts his hands up. And it's just a spontaneous decision. And to say the other officer knew or should have known that takedown maneuver was going to happen is pretty hard for me to see.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, but I think again, when you put it in the context of the screaming of the officer and the swearing at Mr. LaPlante, and the fact that, you know, you can see him in the video looking back over there. I mean, I think there's certainly opportunity and a reason to think that something might go awry, and he could have verbally at least said something, and he didn't do that.
Sure. Judge Clay, can I ask one more question?
Sure.
I see, Mr. Cabot, that this case briefly went to our mediation office. Would there be any value to resubmit it to the mediation office at this point?
Well, without... And I know I'm bound by confidentiality, I guess without going into great detail, my understanding of the proceedings, Your Honor, is that until there was a determination by the court on the qualified immunity issue, that as far as the officers were concerned, that was of great concern to them about resolution. So my understanding from the proceeding is that really, there wasn't much to discuss until the court decided the qualified immunity issue.
Thanks. That's really all I wanted to know.
All right. We'll hear rebuttal at this point.
Thank you, Your Honors. And just to pick up with Officer Kirshen very briefly, the only way it can be liable under a failure to intervene claim is if there was a means and opportunity to stop the excessive force. But Officer Kirshen was all the way on the other side of the car. All of this, as the court noted, happened very quickly. The Supreme Court has rejected the type of claim that plaintiff is relying on here, where he had a duty to sort of de-escalate the situation before it happened. It's only the means and opportunity to stop the excessive force before happening. Back to Officer Ziegler just very quickly. Supreme Court has made clear that it is the plaintiff's burden to come forward with a case or cases that clearly establishes in this specific factual situation that any reasonable officer in Officer Ziegler's shoes would have known he was violating the Fourth Amendment. And that's missing here. The Baker case that counsel discussed involved hands up at a distance and then an officer running up and hitting the suspect with an asp. That's a very, very different factual scenario than we have here in a close quarters handcuffing situation. And respectfully, Your Honors, I don't believe there are any relevant disputes of fact here. A fact dispute would be the plaintiff saying, I raised my hands up, you know, at a distance from the officer, and the officer saying, that's not what happened, and then you need a jury to determine the facts there. What's not a factual dispute, or what is clearly a legal question for the court to decide, is whether any reasonable officer in Officer Ziegler's shoes would have known he was violating the Fourth Amendment when he took this suspect to the ground after repeatedly instructing him to put his hands behind his back, after the suspect instead raises his hands and takes a step to the side. And on that question, there's no clearly established law showing that Officer Ziegler violated the Fourth Amendment. Your Honors, I'd be happy to answer any further questions. Otherwise, we ask the court to reverse the denial of qualified immunity for both of these officers.
All right, thank you very much. Judge Strange, do you have anything further?
No, I think that was.
Okay, thank you very much. That concludes our argument, and the case will be submitted. You can unplug from your devices if you'd like to, and the clerk can call the next case.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.